Okay, so actually, when I started working on the Casimir effect during my PhD, then one of the problems which my supervisor suggested was that he said that if you have two hemispheres, one next to the other, then he said it is well known that they repel each other, and there's no intuition for that, and he suggested that I find some way in which it would be more intuitive. And actually, I thought of it for some time until I got to the conclusion that I don't really believe in that. And the reasons for that are actually more or less what Bob Jaffe was mentioning last week. So, there's also one other reason that really, as you know, the motivation to believe in that came from the calculation of Boyer for the sphere. So one could also say that this is quite different geometries, but even this calculation for the sphere, it doesn't seem really related to anything realistic.
And why not to start with a large R, so to consider just two planes, and in this case it should be attractive?
Well, it should be attractive, yes, but if you believe that this is repulsive, then it's something very surprising.
So, are you saying this is believed to be true in 2D also, or just in 3D?
In 3D, well, I don't know how to draw in 3D.
Sure, I know. What about in 2D? What is known in that?
Well, the theorem which Israel mentioned in the previous talk, actually, it applies also in 2D. So as Israel just mentioned in the previous talk, we now know that if you have any symmetric configuration, then the force will be attractive.
No, I think his question was whether it's repulsive in 2D. If you look at the Fourier calculation, if you want to repeat it in 2D.
Well, I don't remember how that goes. Because I don't believe in that this has any meaning, so I didn't really have reason to look into that very much. So actually, I think the motivation to try to prove that came from the fact that I didn't have enough self-confidence to say what Bob Jaffe said in his talk about why this calculation is actually meaningless. So I wanted to have some proof which nobody can dispute. So I think this was the motivation for that. But well, still, because of the non-additivity of the Casimir force, it's actually not really easy to show that if you have some strange geometry that the force cannot change sign. And the fact that some people believe that it can change sign, this was sometimes referred to as the mystery of the Casimir effect or something like that. And what I'm actually trying to do is to demystify that, to show that this thing cannot really happen. It's at least what I'm trying to do. So the naive intuition, I think, would be that if you have any two dielectric objects of whatever shape, then you would expect them always to attract. So this is something which we're trying to show, or at least in some situation when we are able to do that. Now it is also known that if you consider something more general, like one object which has a magnetic permeability, then it is known that this can repel, at least in the geometries which people can calculate. And this is also sometimes not really obvious where it came from, but I think this is actually not that surprising if you think of it, and I'll try to give some argument for that. And also, if you have two plates, then it's well known that if you have two Dirichlet plates, they attract, but if you have a Dirichlet and Neumann plate, they repel. So I would argue also that this is not really surprising if you think of it correctly. So this is more or less what I would like to say. So first we need some mathematical framework to work in. So this is more or less the same as what was in Israel's talk. So I assume that we have some Lagrangian, so which some quadratic Lagrangian. So it doesn't really matter the exact details of it, but the simplest thing is just to take something standard like that. But actually very few details of how it really looks will really matter. And we have some two objects immersed in space, in vacuum, and they will when what these objects are doing is that they generate some potential for this field. So this can be described if you have some two objects A and B, and the simplest way to describe it is writing some Lagrangian, say like this. And then, these two potentials are not zero only on the volume of the corresponding object, and then one can try to use that, to use this to calculate the energy, and then we would like to know how the energy depends on the relative position of the two objects, and to see if as a result of that the force is attractive or repulsive. Now here I wrote some potential V of X, but actually one can just as well use something more general with V, which can be some more general operator operating on phi, something like, for example, it could be V of X and of del, or something like that. So this is a kind of generalization which should also, we would also like to consider. So it doesn't really have to be a potential, just a potential which depends on X. For example, if you have a magnetic interaction, then the magnetic interaction would be supposed to look something like this. This should be the extra term in the Lagrangian, and this, of course, is from this more generalized shape. Okay. Now, and actually, well, I wrote it like this, but it will be more convenient to work in the weak rotated.
So, sorry for idiotic question. So, yes. Phi is not defined inside of A and B.
It is defined. It is defined
even
everywhere.
It is defined inside, say, if A and B, dielectric materials. In this case, you have dipole. Field yes. Induced here, why it's confined only to A? You have long range. Why V not zero only inside of
A? These electric dipoles are only inside, and they generate.
Yeah, but
they are described by some, effectively, described by some the electric function. So I'm trying to look to calculate things in terms of the dielectric function.
The field is everywhere.
Mm-hmm. The field is everywhere. Okay. It would be actually more convenient to use the Euclidean action. So I'll write it like this.
Probably. This is you don't want more convenient. Potentials.
Okay.
No, well, so, we should ask the question. Hmm? You don't want overlapping potentials.
I don't know overlapping. One object is only here and the other only there.
So, and VA is zero outside.
If something
yes,
fluctuates,
yes, of course.
If something fluctuates inside of A, why B doesn't
no,
know
so the object A generates some effective potential for the field phi. The field lives everywhere. But inside this object, it feels a different potential, a different interaction. For example, like this.
But there are or are not fields inside A and B?
There are.
Okay, fine.
Of course, you can take the limit where V is very large, and then you, then effectively, it is like assuming that there are no fields inside. But I'm looking at something more general. More general and more well-defined. Okay. So the first thing I would just like to try to have some intuition for what we actually expect to have here. So well, as Israel mentioned, we proved that one thing which we did prove is to show that if you have two objects which are exactly the same, one is the mirror image of the other, then they always attract. Now, the intuition behind that, as I think of it, or with something, maybe everyone has his own intuition, but the way I think of it is that the reason is that if the objects are the same, then they like the same field configurations. And then if you have some random field, then they both tend to get to area which are roughly the same. And effectively, this generates an attractive force between them. So if you try to take this intuition one step further, then what you would say that is that suppose that this potential is positive. If this potential is positive, then what you expect is that this object will prefer areas when the field is large. Well, if it is negative, then the object will prefer areas when the field is small. And if you really believe in that, then the conclusion would be that if the two potentials have the same sign, then the force should be attractive. And if they have different signs, then the force should be repulsive. So this is actually this is my intuition. This is the basic conjecture which I was. You are trying either to prove or to disprove. Yes.
You are denoming cos n Euclidean space.
Yes.
To start with. Okay. Good.
Yeah. Yeah. So okay. The conjecture really.
Everything is Euclidean.
Conjecture is that the force, the sign of the force, should be given by the sign of one times the sign of the other, and if they are the same, it's attractive, so usually it is considered as negative. So this is a conjecture. And we can actually check that it works in a, at least in few cases which we know how to calculate this, the Casimir interaction, we can actually check that this is correct. So the simplest one, well, if you have two, suppose, well, let's assume plates, because in this case, everything is calculable. But it's actually correct in any case where it was really, when people were really able to calculate things. So if you have two plates with directly boundary conditions, then the way this is described, the way to describe it is to take the potential to be something, to be very large, go to infinity, and then which enforce the field to vanish on the plate. So this clearly corresponds to a positive potential, and potentials, and this, according to this conjecture, means that you should attract, and we know that it is correct. Now, another case which is well known is the Dirichlet-Neumann. In this case, we know it is repulsive, and this is sometimes looks more mysterious because people are not really sure how to describe Neumann boundary conditions using this, but what I would claim is that it is possible, actually, and suppose this is Dirichlet and this is Neumann. So I would claim that what I would like to do to have this as Neumann is to write something like this, where alpha of x is, well, it's outside it should be zero, outside the object, and inside it should be minus one. This is what I would claim. And, okay, if you believe me, then you see that it will be consistent with what I'm saying, because this is a negative perturbation. So it will be consistent. And, well, you can check that the equations are really consistent with what I'm saying. You can check the equation and see that this really leads to Neumann boundary conditions. And instead of doing that, you can just try to think of it intuitively. What I'm saying here is that inside this object, there is no derivative term inside. So this means if you just think in terms of having some springs with masses, this is just means that inside the object, I just cut everything out. And if I cut everything out, the edges, what I should get is a free boundary conditions, and we know this corresponds to Neumann. So this is the intuition behind that, and you could check that the equations work. So if you accept that, then you see that this also falls into what this conjecture is saying. And other examples, well, if we have the electric function, then since epsilon is positive, we see that should be epsilon minus one here, because I'm looking only at the perturbation. Well, okay.
This was the one-dimensional example.
Here?
No, it's not one. No, you're talking in a more general sense, not just one-dimensional.
Yeah, not just one-dimensional. I'm saying that in one dimension, people calculated this and can compare it. If you take some more general geometry, then you can say, well, you don't know really, don't really know what the result is.
So I thought you were going to go back to that old one. Okay.
Okay.
Actually, I remember that this is, I mean, you know, probably this numerical approach based on word lines, right?
Yes.
So by Holger Wies.
Yeah. And he was it?
So they were wondering long time how they can actually describe Neumann boundary conditions.
Yes.
So you say that might be a
way. That's what I would suggest to them.
They experimented with many kind of different potentials in the
lab. I talked with Klaus Klingmüller. I think they were aware about the radiant square. I think
they
had technical reasons.
I think the way they were doing it, it's more convenient to have a potential. If you start touching the gradient term, it's more
convenient. I mean, their conclusion was that they can't do it, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I suppose that doing it with something which is not a potential would be more difficult, but
but
I don't know enough details.
Change the mass.
Yes. Yeah, that's a change. Basically, so you set the mass to infinity. Right?
In the Dirichlet.
Well, yeah.
Yes.
No, in the Dirichlet, I'm taking the mass to infinity, not in the Neumann.
If I look at this, it's a gradient. I mean, you add.
It's not with this Lagrangian, it's the warp line, so you just take one particle and follow it around.
Okay.
So the mass there couples to x dot squared. That's the,
I don't know. This is not the subject of this talk.
No, okay. No, but just wondering if this could be helpful.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So other examples are, well, there are examples of two dielectrics, and well, for two dielectrics, as for any symmetric configuration, you really expect it to attract, and it works. But if you look at an electric and magnetic object, then really in the electric case, you see that this is larger than zero, right? And the magnetic, if mu is larger than one, this is smaller than zero. So you see that this is also consistent with what I'm saying. So all known examples seem to support this. But we don't have a complete proof for that. This is what we would like to have. Probably I should say that when I'm considering some generalized potential, which is some operator, then what I'm actually mean is that I'm assuming that this is a positive or negative as an operator. Of course, there are situations where an operator is neither positive nor negative. In that case, I have no prediction here. And actually, this is also something which Israel mentioned. We looked in the previous work in a situation where we have two plates with both magnetic and electric properties. And really, in that case, the potential is neither positive or negative. It is a combination of the two. And in that case, really, it turned out that the question whether the force is repulsive or attractive depends on the geometry, not only on the values of these parameters, but only on the geometry. Actually, in the space of these parameters, there were for two plates, there was one line which was separated between the repulsive and attractive area, and for two small point-like objects, there was a different line. And so in this region in between, actually, the sign of the force actually depends on the geometry. So this can happen, but you see it happens in a situation where the potentials don't have a definite sign.
What is on the axis?
The axis, well, these are, suppose, this epsilon. And well, of course, it should be in four dimensions, you know. So this is what I didn't want. Well, if you really want, I have here, put it like this. This is the graph for fixed mu 1 and epsilon 1. So I don't think the details, specific details, I have here the asymptotics of the two lines, but they don't really matter for us. Okay. So this is what I would like to prove, or at least I will try to. So to do that, the first thing we need is some formula from which we can calculate the force. And, well, this was actually the motivation for writing down this TGTG formula. This was my original motivation. But to make it simpler, both to make it simpler and because I can say more definite things in that case, I would like at first look just at the case of one dimension, a one-dimensional system. In that case, I have more definite things I can say. So in that case, actually, the TGTG formula reduces to something simpler, which probably you all know, which is saying that the energy can be written as an integral like this. Yeah, well, here we have again two objects which are now in one dimension. They are in one dimension, and R A and R B are the reflection coefficients from them. Actually, R A is the coefficient, the reflection coefficient from this side, and R B is the reflection coefficient from this side. I denoted this difference by putting a tilde here, but as long as I understand what we mean, I think it's okay. So probably this equation. Yeah, this is a minus 2 ka, where k is k of omega. Well, it's in one dimension.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, if you just think of massless theory, then k and omega are the same. Otherwise, it would be something like, since it is weak rotated, it would be something like that.
It's just straight Lipschitz.
Yeah, this is straight Lipschitz. Although, I for some reason, I don't see this formula written in this general form in any book. Of course, they write the specific case of Lipschitz in many places, but they don't say that it is much more general. I don't know why, because it's so general and so simple. Okay, so.
Question. If you have, let's say, two objects and they have only epsilon, let's forget about mu. Mm-hmm. They necessarily have a definite sign for v. Right?
Yes.
But not only place.
Yeah, because epsilon on the imaginary axis, we know that it is always greater than one. And yeah, and this is also another reason why I'm looking at on the imaginary axis. Many reasons. This is also one of them. So, okay. Now, I probably know this formula, but I still like to mention some of its proofs. So, one proof is what was mentioned earlier is the Crane formula, Crane-Biermann formula. This is one way to prove this. It's essentially this. Another way is what can probably be called the Abel-Plana. It's just to notice that notice the relation between the poles of the scattering matrix and the fact that they are just related to the spectrum, and then use the residue theorem to write this as an integral, and eventually you get to this. So this is a. So for S, what's the residue theorem? So this is another proof, and a third proof which I like is third way to prove this is to use a vacuum pressure. I like this proof because I think it's very simple and very heuristic. If I'm interested in vacuum pressure, what I'm actually proving is this relation, as I'm looking at the force, and the basic idea there is just that you suppose you have some two objects, and you assume that they are being hit from both sides by some random waves, and then if you know the scattering matrix, you can easily calculate what goes here, and what comes back. And then, just from the fact that the amplitude of the of the waves here differs from the amplitude which you have here, you get a net force which is non-zero, and you sum it over all frequencies and you get to this formula again.
It's not the amplitude, it's the spectrum.
It's the allowed modes.
No, because this is in a continuum. So I'm working here in continuum, so I'm summing over all modes.
That's why it's the spectrum, not the amplitude of the modes, which is important.
The force, if you have here some certain amplitude and here some other amplitude, then you'll have and just because of momentum conservation, there should be a force proportional to this difference. You can write exactly...
The amplitude of force, okay.
Yes. So you can write exactly how B is related to A. It's not too difficult. And after you do the algebra, you get to this equation again. I think this is a nice proof.
How do you get rid of the amplitude of A?
Well, okay, you have to normalize A by assuming what is the how many particles are in a given mode. But if you assume that the world is length, which is very large, then this tells you that A is roughly, A squared should roughly go like 1 over L times the occupation number and some factors of pi.
L is what?
L is the length of the world. Of the line, of the world line. So it should roughly go like that when this is the occupation number of this mode.
I understand. And how when you do the sum, the 1 over L vanishes?
Well, you know, when you sum over mode, you have a factor of L from the density of states. So if you use that, and of course, okay, to get the zero temperature result, you just take N equal 1/2. But you can do it also for other situations. I think it's a nice proof. Okay, but what I really wanted was just to use this formula. How can you use it? Well, the first thing which is very easy to see from here is really to see that it's very easy to see that in symmetric cases, really this force is attracts. Because if we are in a symmetric case, then these two factors are equal, right? And since we know that the reflection coefficient and imaginary frequency is real, then this means that this is something positive. If you have here something positive, then it's very easy to see that the resulting force is attractive. This is almost trivial, right? So this actually proves the theorem about mirror images attracting. It proves it in one dimension. Of course, to prove it in three dimensions is more difficult, but actually, one motivation of it was to generalize with this trivial observation which I had. But actually, you can see that actually to get this conclusion that the force is attractive here, you didn't really need the two reflection coefficients to be exactly the same. You just needed it to have the same sign, which is much less. And well, it turns out that it can be shown. This proposition is that if we really have a potential which is strictly positive, then it implies that R is always negative on the imaginary axis. I haven't seen that written anywhere, but it's quite simple to prove that. And of course, you see that this would again give this conclusion. Well, I can also write the other thing, that if V is negative, then R is positive. The only problem with that is that I have to make sure that it is not too negative so as to create a negative energy state, which in one dimension, I'm looking at one dimensional system now, in one dimension it can happen very easily. Well, at least if you take a potential of this form, V of X, then it will happen for any negative potential. But if you take something more general like this, then maybe you can have even in one dimension examples in which this claim makes sense.
I have a question.
Hmm?
So this conjecture there works only for mirror image.
No, so this conjecture, you see that in one dimension, it's all is both.
Suppose you go to 3D.
Well, what goes on? What goes on? I'll get that. I still have time. So I'll get to that.
Okay.
So I wrote down actually two proofs for this proposition, if you're interested, but it's not really too difficult. Actually, what I would like is to have a proof of that which goes as in a way similar to the Kramers-Kronig relation, and I don't know to do that. So I feel there should be something like that. But
But there are other proofs, like I can write down one of them. Maybe this one proof which actually works only for local potential. But if I don't really need the potential to be local, this is more general. But if the potential is local, then reflection coefficient can be calculated using this is equation, which is called the invariant embedding. The way to derive it is called invariant embedding, but actually it's not something too complicated. Well, if you have some potential v of x, and you replace it by potential, which is you cut it here, some x0, and replace it by potential v of x times theta of x0 minus x, and you then calculate the reflection coefficient from here and look how it changes as x0 increases. Then there is a very simple equation, which is goes like this. This is all. What does the record say? Okay. So this is something quite general, which is always true if you do this, if you think of it that way, and just look how things change when you increase x0. And if you just take this equation and look what what happens to it when you weak rotate, so weak rotation amounts to replacing k by an imaginary k, then you can easily see that on the imaginary axis, the r by dx0, the derivative of the r by x0 will be always a negative. If assuming that v is positive, right? If you just take k equal I kappa, then you see that this is always negative. And well, of course, since if we take x0 very, very, very small down here, then the reflection coefficient is clearly zero. Then when we go to the other side, when you integrate the equation to get to get the full potential, you will always get a negative reflection. But this makes sense only for local potential. Actually, it can be proved also for non-local potential, this claim. So, I don't know if it's well known or not, but the thing is that it's true. And you see it proved this conjecture in one-dimensional cases. Okay, so of course, we want next to see what happens in three dimensions. And before doing that, there's one remark which I should make. This is okay. Here I was thinking about having some a single field, right? Phi, which was a single field, but you can also think of a multi-component field, right? And if you do that, you can actually repeat almost everything which I wrote here, except that now the reflection coefficients turn into n by n matrix. And what you need here is to write the determinant of this n by n matrix. And then everything goes the same. But this doesn't cause any difficulty in the proof of this because this claim also holds for matrices. So in that case, you should think of R negative or positive as in the matrix sense of being a negative definite or positive positive definite matrix, and then everything works the same. So it also holds for this case. Okay?
E to the minus KD is also a matrix in between, right?
This? At the moment, it is not.
When you go to n by n matrix.
Hmm? Well, at the moment, this is a scalar. Later, it will become a matrix, and then things will be more complicated. But at the moment, it is still a scalar.
So the fields don't couple to each other?
What does it have to do with coupling? You just have a multi-component field and in one dimension. And for a given omega, it has a given wave vector. What?
Hmm? So the
So you're thinking about multiple contributions to kappa.
I'm thinking of a field after it's reflected from one body and it gets to the other.
You should think of it as the absolute value of it.
Get mixed up.
You should think of it as the absolute value.
In principle, you could mix
So it's kind of that you basically, each component obeys the same Lagrange and boundary condition, and the boundary conditions don't mix.
Well, I don't know. They can mix. They can mix the components. If they mix the components, then this reflection matrix will be more complicated.
But they are not mixed in the Lagrange. They have the same
kind. Well, I don't know. Okay, I can write something more. Okay. Okay, I'll write it in a more general form. So, okay, it will be this plus this, okay? And now V can be also a matrix in this n by n space.
I'm not referring to this term, I'm referring to this
term. This term? Yeah.
It's a sum of. It's a sum of gradient of all the components.
Yes.
If that would be, I think that was what Mehran had in mind. If this would be a tensor coupling, I mean, it could be phi I times K I J phi J, as we have it in electromagnetism.
So in electromagnetism, there's no problem.
Mass in front of this, with material and isotropic mass in front of this gradient terms.
And isotropic material.
Material. Isotropic. Yeah.
Well, actually, you can think, you can do that with non-isotropic materials. Actually, that would be more interesting to use this formula. This formula works also for non-isotropic materials. Actually, I even wrote here a remark to mention it. This will be a 2x2 matrix, and this is another 2x2 matrix, and you use the same equation.
But where it comes, this exponential factor?
This exponential factor comes from what happens? We have one object and another. And the exponential factor comes from what happens when the field propagates from one to the other and back. It doesn't have to do anything with the scatterers.
For multi-component field, it means that phi 1 reflected and not transforming to phi 3.
No, it does not mean, because this reflection coefficient can mix them. They are not being mixed here in the region.
Yeah, in vacuum. It's
in vacuum, but in object 1 and NB, they can be mixed. Yeah. Of course
it's
they can.
It's a question about gradient terms.
No, because this describes what happens to the field in vacuum, and there they are not being mixed, but inside the object they certainly can. Okay. So, where was I? Okay. Okay. So the reason I made this remark, actually, the main reason was because after I noticed that, I had one of the intuition I had was that actually if we have a field in three dimensions, then I can always think of it as take one dimension as special, and we have some two objects, I take this dimension, this direction, say the z-axis, as special, and then I write it as a function, everything a function of z and of the transverse momentum. Then I can try to think of the transverse momentum as if it was an internal index, and then it would look something similar to that, right? So I don't know if this was the motivation for your question, but this is my motivation for thinking about that. And when you try to do it that way, then at first it really looks as if, if the proof which I gave in one dimension follows immediately for three dimensions. But actually, you have to be more careful. So, because it turns out that it does not generalize to three dimensions. And I would like to explain why. So first maybe to do something in three dimensions, I need first to a formula for the energy in the three dimensional case, and this is the TG formula, which Israel already wrote. I'll write it again. So it's quite similar to this one. Looks quite the same. So this is a more general formula. And, well, it's a kind of generalization of this, but it's more complicated in few ways. Well, so one extra complication is the fact that here the matrices were, well, they were, at first it was just a scalar, and then it, when I looked at a more general example, it was an n by n matrix, but here it's an infinite dimensional matrix. So this is one complication, which some people may think it's important for that maybe this is responsible to something to do with the fact that the conjecture does not work, but this is false. Maybe people believe that the sum of integers, of positive integers, can be a negative rational number, can believe that the fact that the conjecture doesn't hold in this more generalized case has something to do with infinitely many modes, but since I don't believe in that, I would say that this has nothing to do with what's going on here. So the fact that we have infinitely many modes is not really a problem, because the matrix which appears here is as Israel mentioned, is a traced class operator. And this means that this formula makes sense. And what it actually means is that, well, there are different ways to define what trace class means, but the property which is important for us is that if we choose some basis, any basis, you can choose any basis for space, and write down the matrix of this operator in this basis. So we'll get some infinite matrix, right? It goes up to infinity, and with a matrix like that, you don't know how to calculate determinants, but what you can do is you can take a block of a certain size and calculate its determinant. This makes sense, and you get some determinant which depends on the size of the block which you chose. And the claim is that this has a limit when n goes to infinity, and which is independent actually of the basis you chose here. So in this sense, this formula makes sense. Okay, so this is the determinant which we are really interested in. So one thing is that it means that the formula makes sense. And another thing which you can notice that it not only makes sense, it actually gives you a way to calculate the energy, because you can really choose some basis and write down the matrix and calculate it and takes n very large. And this is actually an effective way to calculate really the Casimir energy. So this was not the motivation I had to write this equation at first, but of course it's a very good use for it. And so I mentioned we used this approach to calculate the Casimir energy between two spheres at arbitrary distances, well, in the scalar and in the electromagnetic case, and we got some graphs which are. But the basic idea is very simple. Of course, to do the calculation, you should choose a convenient basis here. It makes the calculation easier, and then it should calculate the matrix element, and this is a lot of work, but in principle it's something quite straightforward. If you have a bad choice of basis, you'd eventually get the right result. It would just be even more work. Okay.
So what's the property that you need in order for this convergence?
I just have to choose some orthonormal basis for space.
We have to show that the matrix is trace class.
Well, actually, you see that here.
Going in circles.
No, I'm. What I'm saying is the property that this matrix is trace class is equivalent to saying that this procedure works. It's actually equivalent.
I'm not quite sure. I mean, there's this stuff about this infinite. I mean, you can define a procedure to calculate infinite determinants in this way, for matrices that are not trace class, but only fulfill the Von Koch criteria.
What criteria?
Von Koch criteria.
I don't know that.
That the trace exists in one basis.
Yeah, but I said that this should hold for any basis. So.
That's really difficult to prove. But
what?
When you have put in that it's trace class to start with, and it's.
Are you just saying that trace class is equivalent to the fact that this converges for any choice of basis?
And we know that it is trace class, and therefore we know that it converges.
It's true in both directions. If the determinant is finite, you get the trace class.
For any basis.
For any basis, yes. Okay.
But you have to add the.
I just meant that if the matrix trace class and the determinant to the limit is finite, in the other direction, if the limit is finite, you get the trace class matrix.
If it's finite, for any choice of basis.
For any basis,
okay,
yeah, sure. And that's difficult to prove.
Okay.
Basically impossible to prove.
Yeah, but, you know, this is the property which we really need. The property which we need is to know that you can calculate it this way. So it is equivalent to something well-known. A well-known notion, mathematical notion. This is all what I'm saying. Because if I just say trace class, it sounds something. If it was a talk in front of a mathematician, then it would probably be good enough. But this is a physics talk, so I'm trying to not to use just this terminology, but to relate it to something which is really important for us. Okay, so this is one complication, but as I just said, it is not does not cause us any real problem. Now, the second complication, which turns out more important, is the fact that of course, earlier we had a formula with something like R1, R2 e to the minus 2KA, and of course, or maybe RA and RB. Like it's so clearly this corresponds to this, this corresponds to this, and this corresponds to the propagator. This is obviously this is the way this journal is this. But the problem is that earlier really this was a C number, and now these are also operators, and this really causes extra complications. And one way to say it is to say that if we have a product of two positive matrices as we had before, then it is well known and easy to show that the product has positive spectrum. But if you have a product of three or four positive matrices, then this is not true. The spectrum can be negative or even complex. So, and this is actually what goes wrong in the proof here. This is one way to see what goes wrong. Because, there are issues of ordering which makes things more complicated. There's one other remark about that. One other thing I would remark is, where we are interested in the sign of the force, actually, if you were only interested in the sign of the energy, then actually one can still get over that, and it is not too difficult to show that if the two potentials are positive, that the energy is always negative. This is not too hard to prove. But what we are really interested is to know whether the force is always negative. That is, whether the derivative is always has the same sign. This is the part which is more difficult. Just the sign of this formula is something which I can still get over with a bit of work and still show that I can even do it here. But I think it's less interesting. If you write it in, move things around and write it in a different way, then you can show it roughly what you need. What you need to know is that when the potential is positive, then the T matrix is also positive, and then you write everything like this, you replace this matrix by this one, which is the same up to change of basis, and then this is the product of two positive matrices, and the spectrum is positive. So you can do things like that for the energy, but for the force it's more difficult. And other thing I wanted to mention is that this is formula is quite general, and it gives an infinite matrix, but there are two cases where it becomes much simpler and actually give a finite dimensional matrix here. And one of them is the case of a separable potential. If the potential is separable, then actually this becomes a finite rank operator, and effectively you have to calculate a determinant in a finite dimensional space, and then you can have an analytic expression for the Casimir energy. So this is one case where it is very easy to calculate things, and the other case where it's easy is a one-dimensional case, because, well, of course we have this formula, but actually you can get this formula from here, and the way to do that is to notice that in one dimension, at a given energy, you have only two modes, the right mover and the left mover. And therefore, in that case, actually this is the 2x2 matrix. And when you calculate the 2x2 matrix determinant, you get back to this. So these are the two cases where it is simple. But we are interested in the more general case. Okay.
Why one should worry about sign of energy? I could always have constant.
When we fix the energy at infinite distance to be zero. I always. Okay. So I said that the problem with the proof is that. These are operators, but which do not commute. So this is true, but I'm not sure it tells you anything. I'm not sure it gives any intuition. So to really see in another way what's going on here, I would like to write it in a way that is much more similar to the one-dimensional expression. This can actually be done. Actually, you can replace this with something which looks almost the same as the one-dimensional expression I had before, except that you have to, one of the terms you have to understand in a bit different way. So actually you can write it as 1 minus Ra, again at imaginary frequency, times e to the minus Ka, Rb e to the minus Kb, Ka. Is a decent. Okay. Actually, you can interpret the expression this way. If you give the terms the correct interpretation. So what is the interpretation I have in mind? What I'm thinking of is to take this field and write it in terms of one coordinate and some transverse momentum. Right? And I then replace it by I think of it as same thing as I mentioned before, as a multi-component field where n, when the index here corresponds to this transverse momentum. You would like to think of it this way. And actually, if you do it this way, then this formula is correct when the reflection coefficients are interpreted in this way. But the extra complication, which is really important, is the fact that now k becomes omega squared, well, I don't care about the mass, but it becomes omega squared plus k transverse squared. This is the difference. And the point is that now each channel, well, you can think about if each of these components, the different channels, and each of these channels effectively behaves like as if it has a different mass. And this is actually what we didn't have before. Well, before I didn't say it explicitly, but of course, when we had some multi-component field, I naturally assumed that all its components have the same mass. Well, usually zero, but the point is that the same mass. And we see that when we try to generalize things here, what we get here is effectively, it behaves like a field with a mass, which is K transverse. This is the mass of a given component, of a given channel. And this is what we didn't have before. So if you interpret things this way, then this becomes a matrix, and then you can, then this thing is exactly this one. Okay. Now, once we realize this, then actually you can think, well, in one dimension we implicitly assumed that there is, that all the components have a different, have the same mass. But once we notice this fact, then you can now go back and ask, what if we go back to the one-dimensional case and let different components have different masses? And see whether we can get an interesting effect there. Because we see that in higher dimension, this is exactly what the system corresponds to. So I try to do that and really take what I consider to be the simplest example. So take some multi-component field, but assume that it has a masses phi I and has some mass mi, which is generally different. And, well, it's in one dimension, so I suppose we have 2 points, and we take some simple boundary conditions at the 2 points. So what the simplest thing I could thought of was to assume that here we demand certain combination of the components to vanish, and here I demand some different combination to vanish. I think it's the simplest thing I could think of. Right? So this is the boundary condition here, and this is the boundary condition at the other point. And then we can easily calculate the reflections and do the calculation and get the result and plot the graph. So I did that, and, well, actually I did it for n equal to 2, because this is the simplest case which is interesting. And, of course, the result depends on the parameter I chose, on the masses and the alphas and betas, but you get some kind of graph. So this is the energy as a function of the distance. So if I choose these parameters at random, then usually I get something not too surprising which looks like that. But I try to play the parameters and look at different values of them. And actually, and when you actually choose and more interesting values, you get something different. Then you find out that it behaves like that, which I think is surprising. But this implies that actually in the region here, actually what you have is repulsion. So you see that really you can't get repulsion even in one dimension if you allow for this generalization. And of course in three dimensions, this is actually what you have to start with. It might be in a infinite space, this transverse is continuous, so it may be hard there to think about it. But to make it simpler, you might just think about something in the cylinder, and then this K-transverse would be something, instead of continuous values, it will take discrete values, which are basically zeros of the Bessel functions times one of the radius of this cylinder. And then what you'll get, you'll have some system which effectively looks like it has a field phi n with a mass which is given by zeros of the Bessel function. So the n's zero, okay, phi n because it has two indices, one of the corresponding to the azimuthal number, and effectively it behaves as if it has this mode has this mass. And really, if you put a ring inside, then the boundary condition would be just of the type I wrote here. It will be just of this type. Of course, the coefficients should be written in terms of the Bessel function. But the boundary condition of this ring, if you take Dirichlet boundary conditions in terms of for the scalar field you put here, then what you get in terms of this mode expansion is precisely of this type.
Now, to get that repulsion, you have to presumably assume that the alphas and betas are not the same?
Yes, of course. Otherwise, we have the theorem that, yes.
Right. So, and presumably, maybe there's even some constraint on their signs?
I don't see how you can get it if you take all of them positive, then of the same sign, I don't see how you can get this. But still, this still corresponds to a positive potential, because this corresponds to potential which looks like this, right, times some coefficients which goes to infinity. So it is a positive potential. So for if my conjecture were correct, then this shouldn't have happened. So actually, this shows that the conjecture is false.
That's another numerical result by the group of Janopoulos.
You know, if it takes it as a potential left hand level infinity, it forces the sum to be zero.
And they have handles. So, but the handles are like that, so it's not mirror symmetric. Mm-hmm. So when they are far apart, it's attractive. When they are intermediate, it's repulsive. So when they go very, very close, it's again.
Yeah,
but that's
in your
counterexample.
No, but
that is an example.
Example.
I think which you already that your objects are separated.
Yes, they are separated. Yeah, I think it's in your example, they are not, although I don't
know. But in this case, you mentioned
the overlap. No, they don't
overlap. No, but you can't cut.
No, you can cut. Well, you can tell with your finger.
No. That's
not. Right, alpha n.
The only thing is that we didn't want to overlap.
Right? And this is a function.
Yeah, it's a trivial thing, yeah.
So it's not surprising that they get free
function because
it's geometry. No, it behaves like that.
Close neighbors.
The coefficients here are the alphas.
That one you can.
Some are related to the value of the Bessel function. Function at this value will this is the radius of the ring and the capital R is the radius of the cylinder. But this is just an example. Now I actually was trying to do the calculation by using these coefficients in this calculation and try to get something like that, but that didn't succeed. But I succeeded doing that only when I chose parameters just. I was just playing with the parameters until I found this behavior. But it is interesting. It's kind of open question to see if you can get similar behavior with coefficients which you get by this way in cylinder or some more general cylinder.
I'm still not convinced by your. I agree that sum over n alpha n pi n squared is positive and corresponds. It would seem to violate that, but each one of those pi n's now has a different mass, right?
Yes.
So I think physicality in my mind requires that there should be some constraint between reflection coefficients that is not unrelated to their masses, which is maybe what you are getting over here.
The reflection coefficients, well, the only reason it depends on the mass is because of this dependence on the group velocities. But this is not, I don't think this is what. If you know, if you define the reflection in terms of. The masses enter into the expression of the reflection coefficient, but. So what?
But I mean, this is a path integral, right? I mean, you let just lambda go to infinity. I mean, it's like constraint, right?
No, but I mean, here you have a physical case where you do calculations and you don't get your alphas to be in the range that violates that problem, right? So what I'm wondering with him, is this an accident or there is something that you're not seeing?
Well, I don't know. At the moment, I would bet that it is not an accident, but I don't have any argument for that. So this is actually an open question to whether you can get this behavior by some construction of this type, which we still don't know the answer. Are some things about the behavior of this graph? Well, asymptotics of it can be understood quite easily. Well, if you look at large distances, then we know that at these distances only the lowest mass will be important, and therefore only the field of lowest mass will contribute, and this is the reason why it must attract.
You mentioned that.
Because only. Only the minimal and contribute. And destruction. So this is, and well, yeah, this is maybe something. Yeah, One thing which is really surprising in this example is that if you took any of the two fields on its own, if you somehow could turn off the other one, then actually what you will always get is attraction. But somehow this behavior actually is related to the interference between the two modes. This is what is strange. So at large distances, only one mode contributes only the one lowest mass, and then you also get attraction. But when they interfere, then there's something more interesting. Now, okay, the other limit where A goes to zero is also simple. So when A goes to zero, then what you get is contribution from very high omegas, right? And at very high omegas, of course, there's no effect of mass. And M has no effect. And therefore, again, attraction. So we understand that at both limits, we cannot expect anything interesting here, but some range here, something does happen. But actually, this argument is actually based on the fact that that in the model which I assumed here, we had only finitely many modes. But actually, in the original problem in three dimensions, actually we had infinitely many modes. So we had some mass M1, M2. M3, and so on, and the masses can go on to infinity. And in that situation, actually, this argument does not hold. So actually, you might hope that in the original three-dimensional problem, this consideration will not hold, and maybe you can still get a repulsion up to or down to zero distance. I think it would be very, very difficult to do that because there are too much fine-tuning needed for that, but in principle, maybe it can be done.
Yeah, so they have the proximity force operating, not sure.
The proximity force, but... So you say that at small distances, I can think of it as planar, and then I have the previous... Maybe.
Mm-hmm. In this argument, when you get attraction for A going to zero, did you get a divergence for the force or the force?
No, it diverges. Yes, it diverges. Actually, if I allowed myself not to care about Kramers Kronig and things like that, and take some non-realistic dependence on these alphas on the frequencies, then I could get something more dramatic. But I can get even something like that sometimes. But I don't think I can get it with real omega dependence. Don't believe I can. Okay. So. Yeah, I think all the other things which I had to say, actually, I think Israel did say already.
Good question once more. Are your proofs actually that the force is positive or positive semi or attract also negative or negative semi definite? The reflection positivity is only the weaker of these two. I mean, what Bacher's proof, as far as I... Mm. I mean, from the start, I think he proves only... For instance... There could be no force, right? I mean, that could be also compatible with the result.
Yeah,
force
zero. Sure. It could be zero force all the way.
Yeah. of energy could be zero all the way. And
yeah, but if it's so. Not, yeah.
And the energy could be that can only be monotonic single derivative.
Yeah. Well, so this is the example we have, and I don't know if it can be made realistic or not this way. And we have the other example which Israel mentioned about of a separable potential, where we can also violate this conjecture. But apart from that, the other things I still unknown.
For small a, it's here.